Hello, it's Wednesday, 17th of February. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, is the great housing boom about to go bust because of the stamp duty holiday coming to an end too soon for many house buyers? We're going to be talking about Andy Murray's mother, Judy. She's got rid of something called turkey neck. Yeah, I didn't know what it was either. We're also talking about Brexit Britain, because remember all those doomsters and gloomsters who said all the big car companies would pack up and go home? Well, Land Rover Jaguar's pledged to stay in Britain with all three of its major car factories, which has got to be good news. But first, the rollout of the vaccine continues to go great guns. So why is the lifting of the lockdown being delayed, probably till June or July? I'm talking to a very senior doctor who says it should be lifted right now. But first, some breaking news. Buckingham Palace says the Duke of Edinburgh has become unwell and has been admitted to hospital, where he's going to remain for observation and rest for a few days. Of course, he's 99 and we all wish him the very best. You can go to mailplus.co.uk for more information. So get well soon, sir. At least we can say one thing: the government's vaccination programme has been a great success, with more than 15 million people already having had at least one jab. The cavalry that Boris Johnson promised would arrive. So why are we still facing lockdown until July? That's a pertinent question asked in today's Mail by Dr. John Lee, a former professor of pathology at Hull York Medical School, who's a recently retired NHS consultant. Well, Dr. Lee, you have been critical of the extent of the lockdown for some time. We see this extraordinarily successful rollout of the vaccine. Were you surprised to learn, I mean, we haven't got the detailed route map yet, but the indications from the Prime Minister that July, maybe June, before we start to even think about normality?
Yes, well, I mean, obviously I'm disappointed to hear the government saying that, but in a way I'm not that surprised, because I think, unfortunately, I mean, the government have had a very difficult job to do over the last year trying to deal with this pandemic, but I feel that they've made their job harder by listening to quite a narrow interpretation of the data. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the government themselves don't really understand a lot of the data they're looking at from the things that they say, but obviously they're relying very heavily on the advice they're receiving from Sage, amongst others. And that's a rather narrow interpretation of the data that is exceptionally cautious, and in my view, and in the view of many others, sort of overstates the severity of the viral threat and the effectiveness of the measures they've introduced, while systematically underestimating the costs of lockdowns. And you put those two things together, and obviously that's a bit of a dangerous medicine. So yes, I'm not that surprised, but I am disappointed.
We've seen in the last day or so extraordinary new figures about the number of people who've had their cancer ops and cancer consultations cancelled. But I'm looking at your piece today. You say the statistics are irrefutable. The infection rate now, 142 cases per 100,000. That's the lowest for 4 months, and deaths amongst people over 80 have fallen by more than 50% since the peak. So you say the interpretation of the figures or the data looking at is too narrow. What are they getting wrong, in your view?
I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, really, but I think in terms of the public presentation of this data, it's been very tendentious. So one of the things that hasn't been emphasised to the public is that every winter we have a peak in respiratory infections, because respiratory viruses do this year on year on year on year. We get a large peak of infections in the wintertime. And this year we happen to have a peak that seems to be mainly composed of COVID cases. But the fact that we get a winter peak isn't at all unusual. I mean, last winter's peak was higher than usual because we had a new virus on the block. And this winter's peak, we've got another winter peak here. But the fact that the NHS is busy in the wintertime isn't exceptional at all. And so I don't think people should be misled into feeling this is something truly exceptional. When you look back over the last 30 years, there are other years which have had similar death rates to COVID. And of course, what we've never done before is tested COVID, tested on a mass basis for a particular type of viral infection. And we also haven't had a viral infection that's been like this that have been notifiable. So you put those two things together, it tends to exaggerate the apparent severity of the pandemic. And at the same time, as I say, they've been underestimating not just the missed cancer operations, I mean, but other things that are very important for people's lives, cataract operations, hip replacements, all these things, they really matter. And of course, the mental health aspect of it is enormous. I mean, you're asking young people you know, who may be single, who may be not in a relationship, on their own, to be isolated at home while working for an indefinite period. And that's awful for them. And simultaneously, in the name of protecting old people, you're asking them to be isolated at home and not see their family and not do all the things that make life worth living for them in what may be their last year or two of life. So you put those two things together, that's an awful, awful burden of things for people to carry in the name of stopping a virus that's actually out there now and is in fact not as bad as people had feared it was going to be.
In your piece, you make the point that we now know 225,000 people in England have waited more than 12 months for routine hospital treatment. That's the largest number for more than a decade. But the quite staggering figure that we're now coming to terms with in your piece, it's been referred to in other places, Doctor. By April, NHS waiting lists are on track to reach 10 million. That's a staggering figure. And how much damage do you think that is likely to cause to the nation's health, and then in terms of the physical health, fatalities, and also the economic health of the nation? Do you think the government have got to grips with the scale of this?
I really don't. I think the trouble with it is, as I say, they've been taking advice from their advisors on a very narrow topic. Basically, how can we control the number of apparent COVID cases or the number of positive COVID tests, where they've been pretty much ignoring everything else. I've struggled to understand how people who claim to be public health doctors are quite happy to let a waiting list of that size arise while claiming to be dealing with public health in the best way. Because obviously we could argue about whether they're doing the best thing for COVID. And in fact, there's a lot of argument about whether they are. But to simply ignore everything else simply seems to me to be, to be wrong. I mean, the thing is, it's difficult to quantify, you know, what that waiting list size really means in terms of the nation's health, but clearly it's going to be enormous. And the tragedy really of these lockdowns, which are a very blunt instrument for dealing with viral epidemics and have never been tried before and have never even been considered being tried before they suddenly introduced it, the trouble with the lockdown is that even if the lockdown ended tomorrow, the health consequences of lockdowns will have a very long tail that will probably last several years in terms of mental health and, you know, catch-up operations and people dying of cancer who wouldn't die and all these things. So, you know, it's a very big deal having introduced lockdowns, and to introduce them without a proper risk-benefit assessment seems to me to be, well, really not the way to go. And as I say, it's a blunt instrument, and I think we can deal with pandemics better than we have done with this one, and we should never use lockdowns again.
I just find I was very struck by the analogy you use. You say you're no businessman. Your interest in monetary affairs is strictly medical. The general health of a population tracks the national GDP. The poorer a country becomes, the more illness and disease is prevalent. Well, we now know the economic shock to this nation is probably the worst since the Second World War. Some say far worse than that, perhaps the worst shock for 300 years. How profound an impact is it going to have on the nation's physical health?
Well, I mean, I suppose on one level, it depends how quickly we bounce back from what's been done. But the longer we carry on doing this, I guess the higher the risk is bound to be that the bounce back won't be as great as people were hoping, because they'll have, you know, destroyed businesses and they'll have destroyed people's motivation in the meantime. And so, you know, potentially it's very serious indeed. I mean, there's a strong correlation between GDP and a nation's health. And obviously the less money there is to go around, the less money we can spend on healthcare, on social care, on looking after everybody who we want to look after. I mean, the tragedy really with the whole COVID crisis is that, you know, this is using this method of trying to deal with a pandemic has never been used before. So you would have thought that the government, in terms of coming to its understanding of what the best thing to do is, would want to have the widest range of advice possible, because there are many, many different inputs to this. And unfortunately, what they've done is taken in a rather narrow range of advice that's solely focused on COVID. And of course, that doesn't give the whole picture. And, you know, when you look at the bigger picture in terms of economics, healthcare, mental health, children's, you know, health, all the rest of it, the picture emerging very strongly is that this is a really, really bad way to deal with these things. And the government could make its own job a lot easier if it broadened the debate and started to take a wider range of opinion, because they'd then be in a position to say, right, well, the data actually, now that we're looking at it in a slightly different way, shows something different than we thought, and therefore it is, you know, okay to open up, as I would strongly argue now. But for some reason, they seem to still be wanting to, you know, keep the narrow range of advice. I think that's a grave mistake.
All right, that's Dr. John Lee, former professor of pathology at Hull York Medical School, who's written a very powerful piece in the Mail today. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk, where you can listen to The Andrew Peer Show free of charge and in full, of course, along with all our other podcasts and our videos, plenty of them. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker, of course, to play Daily Mail News. In a boost for Britain post-Brexit, Jaguar Land Rover has recommitted to its UK manufacturing operations. The move will ensure jobs remain in the United Kingdom and that our car manufacturing sector remains strong. How significant is this announcement? I'm joined now by Brendan Chilton, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Business Network. Mr. Chilton, I don't want to reheat the arguments about Brexit, but many people thought that the car companies in Britain would flee to far-flung parts of the world if we dared to vote to leave the European Union. Well, we've seen Nissan just a few weeks ago committing to build its electric batteries here in the Midlands. And now Jaguar Land Rover has got three major plants in Britain, all of which it says it's committed to. Good news?
Well, anyone would think, you know, Brexit was a great success, wouldn't they? I mean, really, what we're seeing is Project Fear was nothing more than Project Fake News. This is a massive boost for British manufacturing and for the automobile sector here in the UK. And that is, of course, going to be vital as we come out of the coronavirus pandemic and the recession. We need to create more jobs, have more things made in the UK so we can sell more and pay our way in the world. So this is fantastic news, and I hope we see more of it in the months and years ahead.
We know that a lot of the companies are going to redevelop some of their products, getting more into the electrical car market. Is Jaguar going to be able to compete and stay abreast of all the dramatic changes in the car market, in your view?
Well, I think what we need to do here in the UK, you're absolutely right to raise this, because it is an increasingly competitive market. We've got countries, particularly in the Far East, who are basically able to undercut the West in terms of their productivity because costs are so much more cheaper in that part of the world. So what we need the government here to do as part of its levelling up agenda is pursue policies that make it competitive and productive to make those component parts here in the United Kingdom. That involves a whole range of issues on supply side policies, as well as the big macroeconomic policy changes we need to see made, particularly on our level of exchange and levels of investment. I'm confident Jaguar Land Rover can do this. They're clearly confident they can do it because they're opening up their new plants here. And this is a massive boost for post-Brexit Britain, where we are not only taking back control from the European Union, it seems as though business is taking control as well and saying Britain is the place to set up.
A lot of the businesses you represent, Brendan, are often family-run businesses or family-owned. How important is it, in your view, that that's still a key part of industrial commercial life in Britain?
Well, the overwhelming majority of businesses in the United Kingdom are either run by families or owned by families, around 80%. They're absolutely vital to the survival of the country outside the European Union and to our key economic recovery. Napoleon Bonaparte once said England is a nation of shopkeepers. Well, we are, and we're proud of it. What we need to do is to see the government ensure, as we come out of the lockdown and the coronavirus pandemic, that businesses have got restrictions lifted upon them, that we don't go too quickly into raising taxes to kill off the recovery, and that we ensure our labour market is as competitive as possible, because one thing the pandemic has done is shown that you can now be living in the UK and apply for a job anywhere else in the UK in certain sectors because you can work from home. And so if they can do that in the UK, we can do it around the world. So we need a workforce that's adaptable, that's flexible, highly skilled and highly trained, and where government gets out of the way and allows business to get on doing the things it does, employing people and making money.
I'm old enough to remember, and I suspect you are too, Brendan, the Pass by British campaigns. And whether it's we're talking about British fish, and we've got a lot of fish in the water, and we've got a lot of arguments going on with our friends in the European Union about fish, or whether it's the car industry, do you think it would be something the government should talk about, that we should be buying British, we should be investing in British products, and not least because China has swamped parts of the world with its goods, and we need to make sure our companies can stand up to the Chinese threat.
Absolutely, and there are two angles to this. The first one is to realise the strength of brand Britain around the world. Many people think we're some sort of clapped out post-colonial country that's still trying to find its way. Actually, a lot of polls have shown that goods manufactured in Britain have got a high value rating around the world. I mean, one of the most classic ones was YouGov conducted a poll
on where people would feel most comfortable having a vaccine from, and Britain came out on top. And so our brand is still strong, and we need to capitalize on that. The second thing we need to do, as I said earlier on, is ensure if we want to buy British and want to see more British goods sold on the world market, we need to make it competitive. The fact of the matter is, our supply side costs here, employment costs, energy costs, land costs, planning costs, are far too high. And that's what stifles the ability for British manufacturing and small and family-run businesses to compete on those international markets. And so I hope when Rishi Sunak delivers his budget or initial statement, at least in March, he will address that area that is a weakness and a ball and chain around the line that is British economy.
Well said. That's Brendan Chilton, who is the Chief Executive of the Independent Business Network. Thanks for joining us. Now, if you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, I hope you do. Why don't you subscribe to us? You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. The tennis player Andy Murray's mother, Judy, emerged this week with the taut neck of a woman 10 years younger. That's her words. Thanks to a new non-surgical facelift technique. But what can the rest of us do about the dreaded so-called turkey neck? Thankfully, there's quite a few solutions on offer. And I'm joined now by the author and journalist, Tanith Carey. Tanith, the procedure Judy Murray went under is something called Morpheus 8. She had three sessions, cost £4,500. So it's not cheap by any means. But what does it involve and how painful is it? Because it looked pretty painful to me.
Yeah, so it involves stamping a set of needles across the affected the region you want to improve up to a sort of a length of about 4 millimeters. So she would have needed a sort of an anesthetic cream to numb the area first. Then methodically, the set of needles would have been passed across the section. So these are, and this works because it's a mixture of microneedling, which basically traumatizes the skin, causing up micro injuries, which makes the skin rush to heal itself. And in that process, it rejuvenates the collagen that has been lost over the years. And at the same time, it delivers radio frequency waves into the lower parts of the skin, which also do the same thing over sort of a longer period. So you've got a sort of a dual effect, and it creates a kind of like a tauter, sort of almost shrink-wrapped effect on the skin that has gone very loose, particularly on the neck.
It's, I mean, the photographs, there was a genuine transformation, wasn't there?
Yeah, and I think that these pictures have given women of a certain age quite a lot of hope. I mean, Judy, by her own admission, has spent a lot of time in the sun watching her sons playing tennis and playing tennis herself. I think what's interesting for me as a woman of a certain age as well is that, you know, 10 years ago we were told there was really nothing you could do about de-aging your neck apart from having a facelift, and that's something that no one wanted. But there's real evidence from all the experts I spoke to yesterday that these non-invasive, non-surgical treatments are really reaping results. And these, even surgeons who are probably losing out on business are saying that they are referring their patients, and patients only need facelifts much, much later on than they used to.
And is it women more like, are women more prone to the so-called turkey neck than men, Tanith?
I think that, no, possibly not, but we're probably more conscious of it.
Right.
I mean, generally there are a lot of areas on, there's a lot of issues with skin on the neck, which made people very avoidant of it, because obviously it's right over sort of some very important nerves and some blood vessels. But I think that women are just more hypercritical of it. But then again, you know, we're also more likely to use sunscreens, which is one of the big causes of sun aging. But what I gathered from the experts I spoke to is that we've tended just to use protective products on our face and just completely forgot about our neck. So what we've had is a process where we've all looked younger in the face, we women, but we've been let down badly by our necks, and then finally we're starting to catch up on that.
And there's quite a lot of other net needle type treatments too, Tanith, I think, on the market. Is this one any more expensive or any more revolutionary than others, would you say?
I think from what I'm hearing is that this has a twin effect, which is quite effective. I mean, obviously, in Judy's case, it was administered by an NHS anaesthetist. And I do think that, you know, when you are putting needles in your neck, you really do need to have someone who knows what they are doing. I wouldn't want to be seeing this rolled out among, you know, more generally in sort of just beauty clinics. Do you see what I mean? I do think you have to be careful. So I think when you're really rolling out the big guns like this particular treatment, you do want people who know what they're doing, and you want research behind it. I mean, you know, there are other ways. You can even use Botox in your neck, which is something that Christy Brinkley has spoken about doing, which was also sort of quite a surprise, because what the neck also has is bands called platysmal bands, which tend to stick out over the ears, and those can relax those kind of, you know, those kind of tent rope effect. So I mean, there's actually, you know, there's quite a big armory of things that you can now do for your neck, which is quite reassuring.
And can I ask you just finally, tell us, how long do these treatments, how long are they effective for? Because she says she looks 10 years younger. She certainly looks terrific. Will she need to top this up in 6 months' time or six years' time? How long does it last?
Yeah, she will need to top it up because, I mean, probably in a year or so, 2 years or so. I mean, these are maintenance programs, really. I mean, they're not be-all and end-all fixes. But, I mean, even with a facelift, you'd also have that problem. After about 10 years, you'd have to rehab the surgery. So, yeah, these are very much maintenance treatments.
Would you have a facelift?
Would I have a facelift? Now, I'm all for prevention, so I slap on factor 50.
Factor 50 sunblock. My partner says, what are you putting factor 50 on for? Look at it. There's no sun out there. I said, that sun peers through the
Absolutely.
Clouds.
Absolutely, and you will look ever youthful, Andrew.
We try. You look fantastic always. Thank you, Tanith. That's Tanith Gehry, journalist, writer, author. Thanks for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's joining me here. Not such a good day for England. They lost that test rather badly. Matt, what's the fallout?
Yeah, they lost it badly. I mean, to be fair, it always looked like they were going to lose it from quite early on in that test match. But the, you know, which would be fine, they could go to the third test 1-1. But the problem now is that they're getting themselves in a bit of a muddle with all this rotation and sending people home. And Joe Root yesterday kind of threw Moeen Ali under the bus a little bit. So this is the spinner who's been out with them since the start of the Sri Lanka tour, who's had COVID, has not been well, played the last test that's just finished, and now is going home. That was always scheduled to happen in this policy of resting players. That was always scheduled to happen. But turns out England actually at the last minute asked him if he wouldn't mind staying on. And he apparently said, well, no, I'm scheduled to go home. I'm expected home, you know, and stuck to his guns. And that's all come out. And it just looks pretty ugly that England would go back on the decision and ask him at the last minute if he wouldn't mind staying, because that puts him in a really difficult position. So the whole thing's sort of just gone a bit wonky for England. It just looks like they don't quite know which way they're headed with all this rotation that's going on. So they need to kind of sort this out heading into the third test for next week. But meanwhile, Moeen, you know, he could well never play test cricket again now. He had retired and he had looked like he'd sort of washed his hands with test match cricket, and he might well do for good after this.
Fascinating. Now, Liverpool back to winning ways, not in the Premier League, in the European Championship, I think, Matt.
Yeah, so in the Champions League, which is about probably the only thing they can win now. And, they put their dismal performances in the league behind them last night and beat Red Bull Leipzig 2-0 away from home. Now, away from home wasn't in Germany where Leipzig are. It was on a neutral ground because of all the travel restrictions, etc. But still, very good performance. Beat them 2-0. Mo Salah scored. Sadio Mane scored. Red Bull did have a couple of chances early on, but Liverpool fans and Liverpool will be delighted that they put this run behind them of three consecutive Premier League defeats to come good in the only competition they can win. So, yeah, back to winning ways. But at the weekend, they've got Everton in the Merseyside derby, and Everton will never have fancied themselves to win this one as much as they will this weekend. So the spotlight will be back on them pretty quickly in the league.
And just finally, in the tennis, you know, one of the few sports I know even a scintilla about, Matt, it's the tale of two golden oldies. So Serena Williams still going strong, but Nadal stunned to have lost even though he'd won the first two sets. Tell us more.
Yeah, so Nadal, you're right, lost this morning to Tsitsipas, the Greek lad who's, you know, this changing of the guard in tennis that we've been talking about for about 10 years. Has never quite happened.
It's taking its time, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's certainly taking its time. But if anyone is going to come through, we've been talking about Dominic Thiem and Tsitsipas, the Greek lad, are the two who could come in and replace your Djokovic, Nadal and Federer eventually. This morning Nadal, he won the first two sets, but then Tsitsipas fought back to win in five sets. So fantastic achievement for him. And it's only the second time in a slam that Nadal has won the first two sets and not gone on to win. So good effort by Tsitsipas. Djokovic is still in the tournament, obviously.
But we don't want him to win. It's too boring. It's too boring if he wins again. It's so boring.
It'd be nice if I know. It would
and
be
we
nice
don't want that.
It.
And I'm glad Nadal's out. All that grunting.
All that grunting and how long he takes in between serves. I mean, that is...
God, hours. And he, and all that, those nervous twitches he's got. He pulls his hair, his shorts, his shirts. His, I can't watch him.
I know. Well, you won't have to watch him anymore. He's
no, good.
But Serena... in her
powers on
suit. Yeah, it plows on to age 39 into
amazing,
the semi-finals, which will be absolutely amazing. So the semi-finals tomorrow morning, she's playing Naomi Osaka, so it's going to be a tough match for Serena, but she is moving better. She said she had an Achilles injury, she feels like she's over that now, and of course she's chasing this one, you know, chasing the final slam, which would bring her level with Margaret Court's record of 24 slams. So I'd just love to see her do it. I know she's been around forever and we're talking about changing the guard and stuff, but I would love to see her win one more. So she's been trying for ages and she looks in good form, but the real test tomorrow morning.
What's your hunch, Matt? Come on, you know I like to get tips from you.
I think it might be a step too far. I think Osaka will win tomorrow morning, and I'm afraid Djokovic will win the men's
event. Oh no. He's up against a qualifier, isn't he, in the semi-final or something?
He's going to win. He's up against a qualifier in the semi-final, so he'll win that. And, you know, he'll probably play Tsitsipas in the final. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong about Serena tomorrow as well.
Right then, that's Matt Gatswood, who is, of course, the deputy sports editor of the Daily Mail. So could Britain's great housing boom about to go bust? New figures suggest that property sales worth $1.5 billion are at risk of collapsing unless Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, extends the current stamp duty holiday. Two-thirds of buyers nationwide are in a chain where someone is dependent on completion before the March 31st deadline. I'm joined now by Money Mail reporter Miles Dilworth. Miles, £1.5 billion worth of property sales. That's an awful lot, and that's going to be a huge boost to the economy if those sales go through.
Yeah, so the government's obviously looking at striking a balance between keeping sales going and ensuring that that amount of money doesn't just fall out of the system, because obviously, you know, there's a huge wider boost to the economy if those sales can be completed, but also looking at the cost of the taxpayer. So if it were to extend the holiday, it may create a black hole of a further sort of £2.5 billion in tax revenue, and £3.8 billion has already been costed for the original policy. So it's obviously going to be a balancing act on that front.
But part of that balancing act, you'll have to take into account, often when people buy a new home, they move into a new home, they buy a new bathroom, they buy a new kitchen, new carpets go in, curtains, there is a huge boost that's related to the house purchase, and all of that will fall apart, of course, if these house sales collapse.
Absolutely. But I think it's important to say that there is hope that most of these sales can hold together, and it will be a case of renegotiating in many cases. So I think a lot of estate agents are perhaps guilty of, well, as one put it, feathering their nests somewhat. So
well, not for the first time.
Well, quite. It's within the industry's interest to get a stamp duty extension, because it has undoubtedly provided a big boon for the market since it was announced on July the 8th. But a lot of independent experts are saying really what should happen in these cases is that if you do miss the deadline and you do get you do end up having to pay a tax bill that you weren't anticipating originally, go and renegotiate your price with your seller. And that is what should happen in most cases, rather than both parties just walking away from the deal. You should get a renegotiation.
Do you think, I mean, it's a political decision for the Chancellor, but he will be under pressure too, because he wants to, I mean, remember the Prime Minister said a long time ago, we're going to build our way out of the slump caused by COVID. Do you think there's a chance that the Chancellor will actually extend the holiday? We've got a budget coming up first week in March. If he even extended it for a month, 2 months, or even 3 months?
Yeah, it strikes me as very unlikely that he'll go for the full 6 month extension, which is what the National Association of Estate Agents has called for. It's thought he's considering a 6 week extension, and that would make more sense. So it wouldn't blow a huge hole in tax revenues, but it would, as best he can, eliminate any risk of these deals falling through by giving a little bit of a tapering off period, a little bit more of a window and an opportunity for everyone to get their deals over the line, because there has been a huge backlog because of demand, and also some suggestions of maybe a way of tapering off the cliff edge so the stamp duty holiday is phased out. Maybe the benefits are, you know, the tax is brought back gradually rather than just one big hit.
He's got lots of balls to juggle, of course, but I see in your piece, Miles, the number of transactions rose by 72% in the 3 months after that tax break was announced. So he will want to try to keep some momentum, won't he?
Well, absolutely. I mean, even out today, we've got figures from the Office for National Statistics showing average house prices rose by 8.5% last year to record high £252,000. That's the biggest annual growth since October 2014. So that's quite an incredible feat, really, when you consider what's going on in the wider economy at the moment. And it's almost the one of the few parts of the economy that's been thriving. And yeah, no doubt Mr. Sunak will want to keep the momentum going somehow.
Just finally, Miles, it's all right for old fogies like me, who's been on the property ladder for donkey's years. So I'm all right, Jack, to see the house prices soaring. But again, it will be gloomy news for a lot of potential first time buyers. You think, how am I ever going to get one foot on the ladder?
Yeah, you can say that again. I mean, that is the other problem with the stamp duty holiday, is that it tends to benefit. You get greater savings for the more expensive properties you buy, and in any case, first-time buyers don't pay stamp duty up to property values worth £300,000 anyway. So, in the large part, the tax holiday hasn't helped them much at all.
Well, the budget will be fascinating, won't it? That's Miles Dilworth, Money Mail reporter, writing in the paper today about the frenzied activity in the housing market. And I make this prediction, there will be an extension. 6 weeks, Miles has got the figure. I thought it'd be 3 months, but I think we'll go for 6 weeks. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'm going to be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.